Good morning, everybody. It's Sunday morning, 26th of November, and Lizzie and I are here again, as we have been every week for the past few weeks, and I am back in London after having been in Singapore last week, only just recovering from my jet lag, so I'm discovering that I do not have the body of the corporate flyer, people I keep on meeting who zip around the world. It takes me at least a week to recover from getting off a plane, so I'm doing quite well this morning, and we are really thrilled to be here and having this conversation again. One of the things that's been so exciting for me in the last week has been reading messages from people who have either been joining us live or who've been watching recordings of this later. We've been posting recordings of our conversations outside of the Facebook group, and people are finding out about them and writing to us and saying that this matters, and it's wonderful to have a feeling that this can touch people in a way that seems important and worthwhile. So we're glad to be doing this again, and glad to be here together. And we have what's felt like a very important topic for both of us, I know, over the last, well, for me, months and years, but it's particularly present now in our lives, which is the topic of grief. So I don't know, Lizzie, if you want to say anything before we read things.
Yeah, just one practical thing. Justin, you said that we've been posting these videos outside of here, and this is a closed group. And I just wanted to let everybody know that when Justin or I posts the video outside of here, it doesn't post the comments with it. So it doesn't expose anybody's comments into the outside of the closedness of this group. But we just download the video of us. And as far as I know, it goes on your blog, Justin, and on our Third Space page, and that's it. So I just wanted to make that clear.
That's right. It's a wonderful thing to make clear. The purpose of sharing the videos, of course, is that people find this and can find their way in. Mm. That's right. And then the conversation that we have inside the Facebook group stays inside the Facebook group. So it's a wonderful way of bringing both together.
Yeah. So I want to also say, some of you may know my grandfather died a couple of weeks ago, and we had his funerals on Thursday. And so this grief thing is alive in my world and my family's world, and my grandfather's friend's world. And I'm really grateful for Justin bringing it. Justin said, you know, are you sure you're okay if we talk about this kind of thing? And I'm thinking, of course, it's like, to not be would be quite strange for me if I said, I'm in this experience, but I don't want to talk about it. It's like, that's kind of the opposite experience I have in my life these days, which is, if I'm in it, can we please talk about it? So I'm really grateful, Justin, that you've brought this. And I'm really moved by how reading these poems has led me into different things. And grateful to be here.
Well, I'm going to say a little bit about what had me bring this. So partly it was brought to mind for me, Lizzie, because of what you've been in the middle of, but in another way as well, it's becoming more and more clear to me how much grief there is in my own life that I carry around with me and has been largely unexpressed, and has been unexpressed in. So sometimes it gets artistically expressed by me in something I'm writing, for example, but has been largely quiet, and it's multidimensional. It's not just personal. And I stumbled across this, was recommended, in fact, this amazing book by Francis Weller that's been such a huge inspiration for me over the last little while. And he has some fabulous things to say about this. So as I've been tuning into this topic too and feeling how liberating it is, and how much changes as I begin to express grief and explore grief and talk about grief. Seemed to me this confluence of what you've been in the middle of in your own family life and this background theme that I've been getting interested in have come together in this lovely way. And so there are so many poets who write beautifully about grief. Mm-hmm. It was actually very hard to choose what to bring. But here we are, we have these two by Denise Levertov and Robert Bly, and I think we should read them and then see what happens.
Cool. So shall I read Denise's one first? It's called To Speak. To speak of sorrow works upon it, moves it from its crouched place, barring the way to and from the soul's hall. Out in the light, it shows clear, whether shrunken or known as giant wrath, discreet at least, where before its great shadow joined the walls and roof and seemed to uphold the hall like a beam.
So this is what Robert Bly has to say. It's called What is Sorrow For? What is sorrow for? It is a storehouse where we store wheat, barley, corn, and tears. We step to the door on a round stone, and the storehouse feeds all the birds of sorrow. And I say to myself, will you have sorrow at last? Go on, be cheerful in autumn. Be stoic. Yes, be tranquil, calm. Or in the valley of sorrows, spread your wings.
So, Justin, when I first read these poems, when you sent them through, and since then I've been really taken by this. So just walking along the street, and, you know, it suddenly lands in me again about this thing of sorrow and grief. And I've been really realizing that I feel like my own grief belongs in the things that are alive more than the things that are so-called dead or don't have a body anymore. And I experience grief mostly in the everyday relationships and places that are normal to me. And so, you know, I wrote a text message to a friend earlier who's having some difficulties, and I was talking about the children growing up, for example, and how my heart already feels completely ruined by the fact that they're even alive and that they grow and they know my name. And it's so funny how in the kind of days of old, I would have thought of sorrow and sadness as like only applicable or acceptable when something's gone wrong or my life is in tatters in some way, although it always feels in somewhat tatters anyway because it's a life. These days, sorrow and grief feel like part of the everyday experience of what it means to be a human. And to have that named in this poetry and to feel the working on it, the acknowledgement of it, the bringing it into the light of a conversation feels so beautiful. And of course, I'm also in the midst of a kind of sorrow that is to do with somebody leaving their body and the shifting of a family because people leave. And that's also the same kind of ache. So I'm in this inquiry about what the difference between anything is in the realms of sorrow.
This is one of the ways of talking about it that I've been really loving from reading Francis Weller's work, where what you're expressing so beautifully, Lizzie, this the deep sorrow that underlies everything, because everything will be lost. Every relationship that we have will lose. Everything that's beautiful we'll lose contact with. Everything that we own will be taken from us. So that's one part of it. And I think I share a similar, of course, I can't know it's the same experience as you're having, but a similar kind of feeling. And this is what has really brought me into this topic, is finding out that there's a big part of me that is a background, has a background mood of deep sorrow all the time, even when I'm joyful. And it's, I think, in a way that's similar to what you're saying, Lizzie, it's often sparked by, not by something tragic, although my sorrow is easily sparked by what's tragic or what in the world is being desecrated or all of that. But it's also sparked by beauty, and it's sparked by love, and it's sparked by intimacy. Right in the middle of all of those is this deep knowing of the temporariness of everything. And so it's true. So I look at my own children and I feel this very often. I feel such joy and hope often, and also all of the losses, all of the losses that are coming. And Francis Weller's beautiful point about this is that until we start to feel and give language to this, and this is just one of five different angles on this that he names, until we give name to it, and most importantly, what we're already doing now by having this conversation together and having other people be part of this with us, until we start to name it collectively in community, it can't take its place, it can't take its rightful place. And also, when we don't have ways of naming it and feeling it and sharing it in community, our grief really quickly becomes exactly this thing that Denise Levertov says in her poem. Our grief is in a crouched place, barring the way to and from the soul's hall. It's such an interruption to our aliveness and our capacity to contribute and our capacity to be wise and deep and spacious. And I could make this huge list. And I'm so struck as we're talking about this, I think this is why we're in this topic, how absent this is from our wider cultures, which is that whatever ways of working together with grief we might have had in the past have been largely stripped from us. And grief's been relegated to this tiny, tiny little corner of our lives where it's allowed to show up briefly and then go away again. Unless you're lucky enough, in the tradition that I grew up in the Jewish tradition, which is so important to me, there are some amazing rituals for collective grief, both personal and collective. And even they, I think, in our contemporary culture have sort of been, they're present, and there's also a way in which they're kind of, it's hard to give them the place that they really deserve. And we suffer so much because of this, all of us.
The line that's sticking out to me right now, Justin, as you're talking, is the where before its great shadow joined the walls and the roof and seemed to uphold the hall like a beam. It's like there's, it's kind of coming to me in my imagination now and in my body where there is this big, whopping, great feeling or experience that is kind of held down somehow or contained in some way that does feel like it's holding up a structure. And it seems to me that the structures it might be holding up are the ones that keep us apart from one another, are the ones that keep us in denial, are the ones that keep us separate and isolated. And there's a softness that comes with this sorrow that builds our capacity to be empathic and connected to one another. And I'm reflecting now on all the ways that this unprocessed sorrow or grief, as we're calling it, kind of underpins so much of the way we feel like or experience that we're separate, and therefore we do things, we act in ways that are not healthy. They are not as we would deeply intend. And it's so interesting. This week I've watched twice. There's this documentary on iPlayer at the moment, and actually it finishes today. So if you want to watch it, I don't know what you do, download it or something, but or watch it today. But it's in part of the Storyville series, and it's called The Work, 4 Days to Redemption. And it's a documentary about Folsom Prison in the States and how men's work happens within the prison system. And outsiders come and join in the process with insiders, and they hold each other through grief, basically. I mean, lots happens, but you could attach the word grief to most of what I've seen in this documentary. And the kind of grief that these men have held in their lives has resulted in, I mean, one guy was in there for a double life sentence plus 25 years for murder. And, you know, there were just lists of those kind of things. And they were all talking about their mothers and their fathers and their sisters who've died, and the way that their fathers treated them when they were little, and how much grief got made that was never allowed to be expressed. And it was so moving to see the statistics that over the years they've been working in Folsom Prison, how many men have been released and have never come back to prison again. And these are like the highest order of crime, and the kind of grief that has been holding up the hall as a beam that these men have experienced has manifested itself in ways that are horrific. And in processing their grief and in being in the sorrow and having the courage in community, being held by other men to face that, has brought them a kind of way of being in the world that means those things don't have to happen anymore. And it was so beautiful. And it strikes me that there's just such power in facing into this stuff. And, you know, the title of our group, our page, Justin, Turning Towards Life, this is it. You know, we are beings, and stuff happens to us in our lives. And sorrow is an experience we all share. And turning towards it, and, you know, to speak of sorrow works upon it, moves it from its crouched place, feels like a deep meaningfulness to, I think, the work of yours in my life, Justin. Mm. It's like, what else are we doing apart from that, really?
So extraordinary what you said, Lizzie, about the way this structure that upholds the hall like a beam is the structure that separates us. Mm. And we, more and more as I look, we live in a culture that has, and an economic system that has built itself on separateness. It's built on, you're on your own, you have to do it on your own, you're only worth it on your own, whatever you can make on your own. Mm-hmm. Don't expect anyone else to take care of you. Mm-hmm. Don't expect anyone to do anything. And our suppression of grief and sorrow, it's seeming to me more and more as we're talking, is part of what keeps that going. Because like you say, it's our sorrow that softens us.
Yeah.
Softens our hearts, but it's also our sorrow that shows us that we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. So hearing this work in the prison is very, very beautiful to hear. And then I'm thinking about, you know, when I walk up the high street in the little part of London where I live, which for a while was a town on its own, and before that was fields, and before that was forest. There's on the front of one of the supermarkets, they have a history of the town, when the main street came and when the first shops came and all of that. And I often read it and experience great sorrow for what was lost in order for us to get here. So I imagine this place, when it was covered in forest land, before people started chopping things down and building things. And I realized that without a place to talk about this with others, again, in exactly the way that you're saying, it's like the background sorrow, that huge sorrow that's not to do with... It's also been the anniversary of my grandfather's death this weekend, and it's not the personal sorrow that I feel, it's more our collective sorrow. It's I'm not even saying we shouldn't have built houses for ourselves. We shouldn't have cleared some of the forest in order that we could live.
Mm-hmm.
But every time we do something to support ourselves that kills something else,
mm-hmm.
our not feeling the sorrow of it also separates us from one another. But it also, I'm taking what you're saying another step further, which is that it holds up a structure that separates us from the world. We feel separate from the forests. And forests, for some reason, seem to be very present for me. And I was remembering years ago taking a trip out to the west coast of Canada, the British Columbia coast, and being on a boat going around Vancouver Island, which is covered in these beautiful virgin temperate rainforests, and seeing hills which had been where the trees had been shaved off the hills, basically. They were like naked hills. And an argument breaking out between the people on the boat, some of whom were feeling deep, deep, deep sorrow for what was happening, and others who were saying, well, it's progress. And there's truth in both. So I'm not making a case for shaving trees off hills at all. It was a cause of deep anguish for me that we were finding ways to live by doing this to the world. But it more and more, as it strikes me, is that our very living, as well as sources of great joy, is a source of great sorrow. And that we have no way, most of us, of naming this, of saying this to one another, of saying, this is the deep anguish I feel for the world because we're here. And the feeling of which, and the talking about of which, and the probably the ritualizing of which, that's the other part that's missing, would remind us of our place in this and our part in this, and remind us of our togetherness in it, and our mutual responsibility for the world, and each for one another. That's so absent from our politics, and absent from our economics, and absent from many of us in our personal lives. And what we get served up instead is game shows. And what I heard recently described as secondary, we live in a culture that meets our secondary needs but not our primary needs. And our primary needs for this kind of conversation, for example, which helps us turn into life, those are the needs that deeply satisfy us.
Yeah,
we can talk and cry and hold one another and be real and true with one another, and our secondary needs are the ones that are filled by entertainment and consumer culture and all those kind of things. And they do feel a kind of need, but they never leave us anything other than fueling our separateness. And how is it, what an extraordinary situation that we've got ourselves into, where our deepest longings are the ones that we most mistrust.
Yeah.
Including our I love this from the Robert Bly poem. His last two lines are so brilliant as well. Like, it's fine to be cheerful and stoic and tranquil and calm. Yes, all of those. But are we willing to spread our wings in the valley of sorrows, which is really where we get to spread fully?
Yeah. There's so much bubbling away in me as you're speaking, Justin. And this thing about being separate and what kind of accountability or feeling gets lost in our separateness. Like, well, if I'm not connected to those trees and I haven't felt grief around what I'm doing, I can do anything I like with those things. Like, if my structure of separation is so built up, it doesn't really matter what I do to you either, because you're not me. And the access point of this sorrow feels like an access point into life itself and a kind of aliveness that feels like Robert, I think, is saying in his poem, spreading our wings in the valley of sorrows has a call in it that feels, to me anyway, more inviting than if I had to choose. You know, I love being cheerful in autumn and I love being stoic and tranquil and calm, but then I get to spread my wings in the valley of sorrows. Like, now I'm interested. You know, it has a quality to it that, and actually this was in part of the documentary, they read a poem that I can't find anywhere, but it was about the fact that the sorrow and the grief that we're avoiding facing is life itself, and it meets us on the deepest level, and that we can trust that life itself comes to meet us as we feel, as we open, as we face, as we meet. And as we do that, we become less separate because we feel part of the web of all of the things, all of the people, all of the trees, the air, the sky. And then because we did that, we care. And so our lives become this kind of excruciatingly beautiful, messy, ordinary experience of some sense of connection that has us act wholly differently than if we were to avoid and skirt around and deny this huge, big somethingness of being human that we're calling by the name of grief and sorrow. So those trees on Vancouver Island, it may be progress because more people might have a home or something. But I also know a bit about Vancouver Island, and there's just whopping great shopping centre that was built there that was really different to the culture. And so, you know, there's so much going on in the world that, of course, is trying to provide for us in some way. But the provision for this, for example, for what we're doing, is not commonplace. The provision for being in contact with one another and in community. Of course, there are places that do this beautifully, and it's not like the norm. I don't have that like in my street, like a little sign that says, this is a community center, come in if you're feeling like you want to share or be with people. Like, I'd have to really seek that out and I'm trying, but like, it isn't. The community of this, for example, is like the deep elixir of my life. And it doesn't feel commonplace, it feels miraculous. And so the generalness of the world is really not into reading poems about sorrow and grief. And yet, when we're in it, when we're doing this, it feels like what life is to me.
Until we can feel and express our sorrow and our grief, we can't really feel what we're doing to ourselves and what we're doing to the world, and we can't really feel our separateness. Like, exactly like you say, Lizzie, the more that it's held away, the more that we held it down, and so much of it in our everyday culture encourages us to do this. Mm-hmm. As we grow up, apparently as we grow up, we ought to feel less. That's the mark of a grown-up in our culture, is that you mm-hmm. feel less and you express less and you say less that's true. And it's what allows us to keep on finding ways to live by shaving the trees off the top of hills and treating each other like we're not other people, like they're not people, yeah. And treating ourselves like we're not people. We've cut off these deep roots because apparently it makes life easier to live, but in fact the consequence is that it makes life way, way more difficult to live. Mm-hmm. And I'm feeling like increasingly a very fierce advocate for the making of collective rituals and practices around sorrow.
Yeah.
And I'm feeling this very strongly today. So in the Jewish tradition, one of the practices is to mark what's called in Yiddish the Yahrzeit of someone who's died. So Yahrzeit is the anniversary. It's literally the time in the year that someone died. And the Jewish prayer that said when someone has died or when you're mourning is hymn to life. So the thing that you say right in the midst of your deepest mourning is you say again and again and again how extraordinary life is. Let's value life, let's praise life, let's elevate life. So I feel so glad that there are, at least in my experience so far, there are these places where the two get brought together.
Mm.
And then you're saying it in such an important way, and it, when was the last time when in school anybody got taught about grief or given a chance to express it? When, and here's the one that's been really exciting me, and I don't know if anyone in the world will ever be open to this, but I'm feeling very excited about it. When was the last time that in a workplace there was an opportunity to grieve for everything that we are doing to the world and ourselves that we ought to feel, that we could feel sorrow for,
mm-hmm.
as well as our commitment to whatever it is we want to bring about? In my experience, the whole world of organizations has been infected, I'm going to say in that very strong way, with this kind of relentless positivity of here's our vision and our mission, and our, as if that without, and here's what it really feels like to be doing this. As if the one side could exist without the other side. And of course it can exist without the side, but it exists in this way that you're talking about that continually separates ourselves. So as we're talking, I'm kind of imagining a radical thing, which is a world in which we took sorrow so super seriously or gave it its place everywhere.
Mm.
How differently we'd live. And I imagine how much more joyfully we'd live. That this is the path to joy as well, is to feel all of this. And we didn't even get on to talking about these amazing five different gates of grief that Francis Weller brings, all these different kinds. Maybe we'll circle back to it some point in the future. But how about that sorrow and aliveness and our deep humanity are so closely connected?
Feels very truthful.
Mm.
And true to my experience as well.
Mm.
And the more I feel the grief and the sorrow around the people that I love, for example, the more fun I have with them, because I just let go of all of the stuff I don't really need to think about. It's just the stuff that doesn't matter gets dissolved, and it becomes joyful just to be with people and to find beauty gets easier, and to find appreciation becomes natural rather than to find fault. So I'm really grateful to be saying these words and connecting everything together, and also knowing that we're onto something and other people are onto it too. It feels good.
So I can see that we need to make these couple of hours, I think, Lizzie, and we'll be able to really talk about things the way we want to talk about them.
Or 5 days.
Yeah. Well, yes. I want to name a couple of resources, because these are two things that have been at least part of my background to coming to this. So one is, the main one that I've been talking about is Francis Weller's book, The Wild Edge of Sorrow, which has such a super name as well, The Wild Edge of Sorrow by Francis Weller, that I'm enjoying so much. But the other thing that I came across this week that has been very nourishing for me has been a podcast. So Francis Weller and Charles Eisenstein have a fabulous conversation about all of this on Charles Eisenstein's podcast, which I think is called A New and Ancient Story. So those are two streams that I've been drawing on in the last week as we've been coming up to this call that I wanted to tell everybody about.
Lovely. So we'll see everybody again next week, and we'll see each other next week as well, Justin.
Yes.
I'm going to turn us off.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Bye, everyone.